Senate Judiciary be in order. Secretary, take the roll, please.
Senator Usher.
Here.
Senator Gross.
Here.
Senator Heinbaugh.
Here.
Senator Emmerich.
Here.
Senator Weber.
Excused.
Senator Manzella.
Here.
Senator Olson.
Here.
Senator Brown.
Here.
Senator Friedel.
Here.
Senator Kelker.
Here.
Senator Regeer.
Here. Committee, we have four bills that we're going to hear today. Those of you that are in the chambers that have a cell phone, please turn the sound off so it doesn't disrupt the proceedings. If you're going to testify on a bill, there is a witness sign-up sheet at the entrance to the chamber. And when you do testify, give us your first and last name at the beginning and spell your last name for us. With that, we'll open the hearing on House Bill 112. Representative, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, good morning. Thank you. I'm Jodi Etchart, J-O-D-E-E, last name Etchart, E-T-C-H-A-R-T, representing House District 48 in Midtown Billings, here to present House Bill 112 for your consideration. Human trafficking is a form of modern-day slavery where traffickers, which are often organized criminal enterprises, profit at the expense of adults or children, compelling them to perform labor or engage in commercial sex. Cases in Montana are on the rise. Montana Department of Justice human trafficking investigators initiated 64 cases in fiscal year 2022. In 2021, there were only 16. That's a 300% increase. That's why Attorney General Austin Knutson and prosecutors in his office worked hard to identify how to strengthen the statutes to include more tools for prosecutors to hold criminals accountable while also protecting victims exploited by this heinous crime. The legislature passed human trafficking bills in the last several sessions, and they were a good start, but we need to strengthen the laws to make them easier for prosecutors to use and hold offenders accountable. House Bill 112 will accomplish that. No one has been convicted under Montana's existing human trafficking statutes. Instead, if a case does not go federal, county attorneys and the Attorney General's office must rely on statutes such as the Promotion of Prosecution to prosecute sex traffickers in our state. And why? Because the Promotion of Prostitution statute is easier to prove and carries a higher penalty than the newer human trafficking statutes. And I think we can do better. And House Bill 112 does exactly this. It adopts the Promotion of Prostitution statute into human trafficking sections and reorganizes the offenses into four easy-to-understand categories that include sex trafficking, aggravated sex trafficking, child sex trafficking, and labor trafficking. This clarifies the crime and makes the language easier to understand for prosecutors, for law enforcement, for victims, and for potential jurors. House Bill 112 increases punishments for offenders, both those that encourage or compel a victim to engage in commercial sexual activity and those that patronize the system. Not only are overall sentences increased, but the bill provides for mandatory minimums for the worst offenders. The statute will still allow a judge to use his or her discretion, but requires a judge to explicitly make findings as to why they are deviating from the mandatory minimums. Additionally, House Bill 112 makes clear that those who patronize or encourage sex trafficking of a minor will be strictly liable for their conduct. They won't be able to say, oh, I thought that that child was an adult. They won't be able to use that defense. And the defense that the child consented, well, we're not going to be doing that either. So you will hear from the Attorney General on how House Bill 112 tells offenders not in our state. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee.
Any proponents in the room?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, Attorney General Austin Knutson, K-N-U-D-S-E-N, here today in favor of House Bill 112. Members of the committee, Mr. Chairman, human trafficking is probably the most heinous thing I've ever seen in my life. For those of you who may not know my background, right before I had my current job, I was the prosecuting county attorney up in Roosevelt County. And you might think, well, that's a small little rural county. What could you possibly have seen? Some bad things, but I've really had my eyes open to the world of human trafficking since I've been elected to this position. During the campaign for the job, I had the opportunity to meet with a number of nonprofit organizations here in Montana that are really doing some fantastic work in the human trafficking world, and got myself really educated on just the breadth of this crime the evil of this crime, and there is no other word for it. This is truly the most evil expletive I've ever seen in my life. We are talking about modern slavery. I'm going to start with a couple of statistics. I mean, just from last year to 2022 to 2021, our human trafficking cases have increased 300% at DCI. But I'll hit you with an even more staggering one. Since 2015, our human trafficking investigations at DCI have increased 871%. Now, does that mean that we're seeing a huge increase in human trafficking in Montana? I actually don't think so. I think this has been here. I think this has been going on for a long time. I think we are just now finally willing and able to recognize it for what it is. And what do I mean when I say that? Well, one of the best analogies I ever got was from an investigator in Missoula who does this day in and day out. And his analogy is, for the long time, Montana has treated human trafficking like we treated domestic violence in the 1950s and the 1960s. We didn't talk about it. It made us uncomfortable. That was a private thing that happened between two people, and it kind of made us all feel a little yucky. No, that's not acceptable anymore. In today's society, we do not accept that domestic violence just happens. We have laws in the books. We punish offenders. We have criminal statutes. Society does not accept domestic violence. And I think we are finally getting there as a state with human trafficking. Well, what do I mean by that? For a long time, we treated this like simple prostitution. No big deal. Nobody's really getting hurt. Victimless crime. Two willing parties, right? The penalties really weren't that stiff under the law. I can tell you just from what I've learned, and you're going to hear from some other far more knowledgeable folks than I, we're not talking about willing parties here. That might represent half of 1% of these illicit sex transactions that happen. The huge majority of these cases are victims of slavery. They are forced into this. No one wakes up one morning and says to themselves, well, you know what will be a great way to make a living? Let me go be a prostitute. These are people who are forced into this industry. We're talking about the sex trade. Not always. We certainly do see some labor, some forced labor instances. We do have some of those investigations going here in Montana as well. But the lion's share of what we're talking about here in Montana are sex trafficking. These are individuals, victims, typically young females, not always, but typically young females, underage, who are trafficked into this state by a pimp to engage in illicit commercial sex against their will. And I apologize if that makes us uncomfortable, but that's what we're talking about, and we have to go into this discussion with our eyes wide open. So the bill before you, what you see, is really us bringing Montana into the modern age, talking about human trafficking. I want to give credit to where it's due. A couple of sessions ago, then Representative Dan Zolnikoff, current senator, started us down this road and did some good work, got us a couple of human trafficking investigators at DCI who they are just absolutely doing a fantastic job. But we are seeing just more and more and more of these cases because as we peel the layers of this onion back, we are finding more and more of these things. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I don't want to belabor the point. We've got a lot of good proponents here to talk about this. Got some good expertise here behind me. The bill that you see in front of you does a couple of really important things before I sit down. I won't touch on all of them. I'm going to touch on a couple of them. One of the ones that I think is the most important is we've specifically carved out child sex trafficking and added an enhancement if you're trafficking minors. There's probably nothing more evil than any of us can think of. We didn't have a carve-out for that before. There was no sentence enhancement. There was no specific penalty for trafficking children before. So you see that in front of you. That's got a mandatory 100-year sentence with a 25-year no deferral, no parole requirement, which I think is very important and will send a very strong message to the traffickers. But on the other side of that, the other thing that we really haven't dealt with in this state is the demand side. Because we have to understand, this is simple economics, right? There would not be traffickers here in Montana if there were not a demand for it. If there were not people who were willing to get on these illicit websites and order sex with a teenager. So, again, dragging us into the 21st century. Our current state law right now, you can solicit prostitution with a child 4 times, and it's a misdemeanor, all 4 times. I think that's horrifying. So the bill you see in front of you, that now becomes a felony, a first-time felony. If you solicit illicit sex, you're going to get whacked with a felony under this statute you see in front of you, our proposed legislation. This is a product of a lot of collaboration. We've brought together a number of human trafficking symposiums. We've gotten a lot of nonprofits in the room together. One of the great things about Montana, we've got a very robust community of nonprofits who are working in this sector. We really are kind of a state leader in that field. But a lot of law enforcement professionals, a lot of prosecutors have fingerprints on this. So what you see here is the product of a lot of collaboration and a lot of just knowledge, frankly, Mr. Chairman. So happy to stand for questions and hope you'll move this one along. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, member of the committee, my name is Dan Gusinski, G-U-Z-Y-N-S-K-I, and I'm the Bureau Chief of Prosecution Services Bureau. The Attorney General's Office, the executive team, asked the Prosecution Services attorneys, the prosecutors, this would have been last summer, to look at our human trafficking statutes and look where the failures are and talk to our county attorneys and see how we can do better. And so myself, and I'd like to give also a lot of credit to Celine Kepke, Prosecution Services Bureau attorney, worked on this. And I would like to just say one of the cases that we did, the Hoag's case, I think just puts a face to what we're talking about here. A young girl, as real as anybody in this courtroom, 17 years old, in New Mexico. And this is the case we prosecuted, and DOJ, DCI officers investigated. But it started off in New Mexico, having trouble with drugs and family, and she gets partnered up with a lady named Felicia. And Felicia was a middle person who worked for a person named Mr. Hoag's. The sophistication of this crime is really something to marvel at, because the victim couldn't go to the bathroom, couldn't eat, couldn't do anything without permission of Mr. Hoag's. But Mr. Hoag set up this whole thing where he never actually met this young girl. There was a middle person, Felicia, who maybe was at some point brought into prostitution by Hoag's, but she manages Mr. Hoag's, the women that he trafficked. That girl traveled all the way through the states, all the way up to Montana, having sex with various men, and still having her drug addiction, and still being controlled not only in the men that she would be with, but also in what she did every day, her daily living. And finally, the work of the DCI agents that A.G. Knudsen talked about uncovered it online. And they were able to make an arrest, a really difficult arrest. It dealt with a lot of electronic information, a difficult arrest of Mr. Hoag's. And the problem didn't just end there, because now we have a girl that's been addicted to drugs who is our main witness, and we have to keep touch with her for the next year and a half before trial. Well, we didn't. And I think one of the bills that this legislature is looking at is trying to have some victim services for trafficked victims of sexual slavery to make sure not only do they get the community services, but also that they stay in contact with law enforcement and prosecutors. But we lost her. And again, you look towards the good work of AGs Knudsen's DCI officers that came together to try to find her, to bring her to trial. And she came. Once she was found, she wanted to stop this life. She came to trial. And during her questioning at trial, what was really fascinating is she was questioned about, you've never actually met Mr. Hoag's. You never saw this person, did you, that you say trafficked you? And she said to the witness stand, yeah, I did. There was one time he messed up. He was talking to Felicia, and I saw that picture on that Zoom, on that FaceTime, whatever it was. I saw you. And she points and says, I saw you. I saw you go tooth. I saw you. You didn't know I saw you, but I saw you. And Mr. Hoag's is in Montana State Prison right now for the work and the resources that this legislature has put forward and the work that the Attorney General's office has done. And that's kind of the cases we're talking about here. This bill, when we talk to county attorneys around the state on why the good work of the prior legislature, the 2015-2017 legislatures, when they brought human sex trafficking bills forward, why they weren't being used, why we were still looking at these promotion of prostitution statutes, why were prosecutors who were charging sex trafficking using a statute that doesn't even sound like sex trafficking, promotion of prostitution. It's because it was easier language. The model language that was brought before and passed by this legislature was wonderful and it was noble, but it was very hyper-technical. It was very, very wordy. So what we did when we looked at this bill was take the language that's being used with promotion of prostitution, which is sex trafficking, that language, and we brought that into this bill that's before you today. And we also kept some of the other good parts of the other legislation that was passed in the previous legislation about sex trafficking. And so we made it easier. It is set up in generally three sections. We have sex trafficking, and that is the new 45-5702. It's on page 20 of the bill, at least the bill that I've been reviewing. And then we have aggravated sex trafficking, which is 45-5706. And then we have child sex trafficking, which is on page 27, which is new section 19. And so it breaks it down into three easy components. The penalties are increased for all of these. And given that this bill has some length to it, because of all the references to other statutes and stuff, those are three of the primary areas where we did it, the three parts, which is sex trafficking, aggravated sex trafficking, and child sex trafficking. And I think really what this bill does is it certainly punishes and holds accountable people that will involve in this horrific conduct, as A.G. Knudsen described it, and I wholeheartedly agree. But also what it does, it has a huge deterrent effect on anybody that would do this. And unlike other statutes where people look at psychosexuals to see why a person committed a crime, a sexual crime against the children, trying to get into their background of why they would hurt a child in this fashion, what this is all about is nothing to do with this. This is pure greed. Pure greed for money, to sell somebody for money. And this is financial. And so the penalties are harsh. But I think this legislature sends a strong message, if this is approved, that you should not do this in Montana. And you shouldn't do it anywhere, but you shouldn't do it to our children in Montana. So I'm available for any questions, and I would ask that this pass. Thank you.
Any other proponents?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Steve Crawford. Stephen with a V. Crawford is C-R-A-W-F-O-R-D. I'm the Bureau Chief of the Narcotics Bureau at the Montana Division of Criminal Investigation at the Department of Justice. Here in support of House Bill 112, my bureau houses the human trafficking unit. I have our human trafficking supervisory agent with me here today. I think a lot of what I would say it would be duplicative of the Attorney General and Mr. Gazinski as well as the sponsor, but I would kind of reiterate that the sponsor did a good job of describing what this bill does, and Mr. Gazinski lined out for you that this will make it a clearer tool for us to bring these cases, make these charges easier for both law enforcement and prosecutors to work with. And I think the Attorney General did an outstanding job of describing the scope of the problem and the scope of the issue that we're seeing across the state. It is our top priority, that and narcotics enforcement we are heavily engaged in. And so this bill will really bring things, give us a better tool in the toolbox and a clearer field to work with. I would ask permission to be excused or answer any questions, as I have a 10 o'clock conflict, but my human trafficking unit supervisor will be here for questions.
That happens a lot around here. Committee, any questions for Mr. Crawford? Senator Gross.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Crawford. Can you just quickly tell us what is the significance of a narcotics investigation when we're discussing human trafficking investigations?
Sure, Mr. Chair, Senator Gross. They are often intertwined. We see human trafficking is not involved in every drug investigation, but drugs are involved in almost every human trafficking investigation. So there's a lot of overlap. There are some organizations that are doing both. So at the organized crime level, at the cartel level, there are human trafficking as well as drug trafficking going on. So they are really intertwined. And they occur in some of the same locations with the same victims.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Crawford. You're excused.
Thank you.
Any other proponents in the room?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Andrew Yednock, Y-E-D-I-N-A-K. I'm the supervisory agent in charge of the Montana Department of Justice Division of Criminal Investigations Human Trafficking Unit, which is housed under the Narcotics Bureau. I'm here in support of House Bill 112. I'm here to answer any questions that you may have. To speak a little bit more to what the question that Chief Crawford was just asked, drugs are oftentimes utilized as the holding pattern for these victims. It is the item that is used to either keep them in control by the intoxicating effects, but also by the addiction itself. Without that drug to appease that addiction, the pain that victim goes through, that drug is what is supplied to them by the trafficker. These cases are extremely long-term investigations. Several investigations that I have done have taken much more than 1, 2, or even 3 years. The largest human trafficking investigation I've done to date took approximately 3 years to investigate. That was a case in which an individual had trafficked young women from the Billings, Montana area down to Denver, Colorado. The main purpose in that was trading those women for drugs in Denver to be brought back to Billings, Montana to be distributed. Also within that investigation, there was two individuals that were kidnapped, two young women, one being a Native American female off of a Crow Indian reservation, another being a family member of this individual, that were kidnapped for the purposes of commercial sex. These crimes are heinous. They are expanding. And I would differ in a little bit of what the AG said in that people are now coming to Montana for the purpose of human trafficking. Yes, they've always been here. These cases are ones that are not new to Montana. We're getting better at recognizing them. That is why our cases have gone up. But I've talked to numerous victims throughout my cases that we've interviewed that have told us that they come to Montana because the men that are here will pay more. And they don't haggle for the prices. The men are more gentlemanly, if you would have that, and they can operate during the daytime hours. So it keeps them from having to operate into the night, and their pimps send them up here because they can make more money in those daytime hours. So we are seeing an influx of individuals coming to the state of Montana specifically for the purposes of engaging in commercial sex. Again, I thank you for this opportunity. I'll be here to answer any questions.
Any other proponents?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Amy Grimalis. The last name is Grimoljez. I'm an attorney at the Crowley Fleck Law Firm, and we represent both the City of Billings and Billings Clinic. We rise in strong support of this bill for the prior testimony given, and you've heard about the crime rate in Billings. This is just a part of that problem as well. We think the bill goes a long ways towards helping with that. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Scott Richner, R-E-I-C-H-N-E-R, representing Montana Lodging and Hospitality Association. Today, we rise in strong support of House Bill 112. We appreciate the sponsor and the Attorney General for bringing this and their leadership in this endeavor. Obviously, it's a big issue, and we appreciate your support and do pass. Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Regeer and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Nanette Gilbertson, G-I-L-B-E-R-T-S-O-N, here on behalf of both the Montana County Attorneys Association and the Montana Sheriffs and Peace Officers Association in support of House Bill 112. I don't want to belabor the points that have been made, but I do want to track back to what our Attorney General said regarding the human trafficking symposium that were held around the state during the interim. I was able to attend one of the symposium, and it was a broad group of stakeholders from legislators to prosecutors, law enforcement, and nonprofit associations. And the Department of Justice was very receptive to listening to issues, listening to solutions, and they brought forward much of what was discussed in House Bill 112. So I feel like this is a collaborative bill. They took input from people on the ground working these investigations and moving these prosecutions forward, and I think you have a great bill in front of you. I'll also say that if and when this bill passes, there will be a training component that will be necessary for local law enforcement and prosecutors Fortunately, we currently have a great collaborative relationship with the Department of Justice for both the local law enforcement and local prosecutor side to ensure that they know what the new law says and how to appropriately implement it to help have good investigations and move prosecutions forward. So I would encourage a due pass. Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Dan Smith, S-M-I-T-H. I'm the Executive Director for the Montana Police Protective Association. We come in support of this bill as there's not a lot that we can add to all the previous proponents. I believe this bill gives law enforcement across the state the tools needed in the toolbox to adequately protect our citizens. Thank you.
Good morning, members of the committee. For the record, Dwayne Williams, W-I-L-L-I-A-M-S, and I'm the Executive Director for the Montana Trucking Association. I'd like to thank the sponsor and all the work of the Attorney General in his office on this issue. A lot of times our drivers are the eyes and the ears out there when this happens. So we work with the Attorney General's office to help train our drivers so that they can be more educated. So we appreciate any efforts to help curb this. Thank you.
Any other proponents?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Deborah Pitassi, last name spelled P-I-T-A-S-S-Y. I am here as the Executive Director of the Montana Beer and Wine Distributors Association. We founded the Sentinel Project, which is a public-private partnership with the Attorney General's Office as well as statewide law enforcement. A word that I think that we should remember when we think about this bill is awareness. That's been very important to us in terms of training our people because pretty instantly people think that it's not happening here. I know you've heard a lot of testimony that is pointing out that it is indeed happening here. I have had the opportunity in learning about the issue in the state of speaking with survivors. And there's one thing that they need, and that is hope. They need to know that there are people that care. And just to briefly put a face to this, I think there's a lot of stigma. There's a lot of confusion surrounding what trafficking looks like. There's images of, you know, movies and the like of it being something that somebody wants to do, that, again, they wake up and decide to do that. That is not the case. How could somebody bring themselves to do something like that and be okay? Well, oftentimes it's a trusted person in their life or that comes into their life that treats them with respect and kindness and shows them something that maybe they never felt before. And then one day there's an ask. Will you just do this one thing for me to help me get through? So I say that and I share that with you to convey that this isn't a certain type of individual. This isn't just the hard luck folks, the drug addicted. This is anybody. There are cases that I've heard of as young as 7 and as old as a woman in her 70s. So please keep that in mind when you're looking at this. It's important that we spread awareness, that we understand the issue, and that we do our part to make sure that the folks that are taking advantage of these people, both on the pimp side of things as well as the Johns that are seeking this out, realize and recognize that in the state of Montana, this can no longer be the case. Thank you.
Any other proponents? Proponents. There are none online. How about opponents? Any opponents in the room to House Bill 112? Opponents? How about informational witnesses? Any informational witnesses? Seeing none, questions from the committee? Senator Kelker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A question for Mr. Crawford, please. Oh, he's the one that left. Who's next in command? Yeah, I'm sorry.
Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And tell me again your last name, please.
Yednock, Y-E-D.
Yednock.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, got it. I actually spent hours last night trying to figure this all out. I'm from Billings, and this is not a new topic at all for me or for the community in Billings. So I would like to have, I mean, this is a long bill. Mm-hmm. And I'm just going to ask you, are these the important points? Am I missing something? Are you ready? Okay. It sounds like harsher punishments, especially aggravated sex trafficking. That's one. Mm-hmm. It also seems that more attention to children, which, and I don't know for sure what children means, up to 18 maybe? Is that what we're thinking about?
Yes, ma'am, under the age of 18.
Okay. And so all of this is a lot to get your hands around. So are there other big things that I should be thinking about that are going to be different from what already is happening?
To answer your question, I believe, yes, you are correct in that the focus of this is not only to give harsher penalty to these crimes, but also, as Mr. Kaczynski had said, to clean it up a little bit. The way that these laws were previously and the way that we had to use them, they were within different sections of our statutes, and they were called different things. As he pointed out, promotion of prostitution. To charge somebody with promotion of prostitution, it puts a stigma on the victim, being that they were a prostitute. That is a word that I have come to loathe. These are victims. These are survivors of heinous crimes. So it cleaned the laws, or it's attempting to clean the law up a little bit, to put everything under one umbrella and to call it what it is, sex trafficking. Yes, there is a more of a focus on children as well, making those aggravated factors. One thing that you may be shocked to find is I have an agent in Billings that is assigned to the FBI. They have a human trafficking task force there. And in speaking with him, he has been struck by the fact that when they go out and they do proactive operations online where they are posing as young individuals that are being commercially sex trafficked, meaning young women the ages of 13, 14 years of age, they will immediately get contacted by Johns wanting to engage in commercial sex with those young women. When we pose as adult women, there's much more of an ebb and flow of cases with that, of people wanting to. It's almost as if they they understand that the police do those type of sting operations, if you will, so they're more cautious. But the fact that individuals are chomping at the bit to have sex with children in this state is appalling, and it's happening every day. So to, I believe, answer your question, yes, you are correct. There is a focus in aggravating factors on children, but the main purpose of this also was to bring everything into more of a fluid channel for us to be able to utilize.
Thank you. May I add one more question, please?
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And what, if anything, is different in how we treat the survivors or the victims of the crime? I mean, we have all kinds of programs that are funded and not funded for victims, but is there anything that we're going to be doing differently for survivors?
Mr. Chair, yes, ma'am. The Department of Justice takes a very much of a victim-centered approach in the way that we do our investigations. My biggest goal anytime I enter into an investigation is to be able to prove that case up without ever needing that victim to testify.
Oh.
That's my goal. I don't always succeed in that goal, but that is my goal because I don't want to re-traumatize that victim by putting her on the stand to have to relive that trauma that she experienced at the hands of her trafficker. Furthermore, these victims and these survivors are somewhat different in a lot of ways. The best that I can equate it to, a question that I often get asked, which I absolutely hate, is why didn't they just leave? Well, because there's a trauma bond there. And the best way that I can explain that is somewhat similar to a domestic dispute or a partner family member abuse case, where the wife or the female in that case tells you, well, I love him for the times that he's good to me. These traffickers will provide for these victims. They will provide them clothing. They will provide them narcotics, as I stated before. Nice, luxurious things. Take them on trips. And then require them to engage in commercial sex. And when they don't, oftentimes physical abuse follows that. Well, why wouldn't she just leave in that situation? Because he then turns right back around and starts lavishing her with those wonderful gifts again. And she loves him for the times that he's good to her. That's the best way that I can try to explain that, of that traumatization that occurs within the mind of a victim. So what we will be doing going forward is focusing more so on that. Our hope is to add a victim advocate specifically for human trafficking that will partner with my unit and will be with us every step of the way to maintain that contact, as Mr. Gazinski had stated, which is oftentimes hard to do from the law enforcement perspective because we're here to investigate crimes. Having that victim advocate to maintain that contact with the victims and help them through the legal process and point them towards the services that exist within Montana for them.
Thank you. That's what I wanted to hear. Appreciate
it. Mr. Yednak, while you're there, question if you could go a little farther. How tough is it to get a conviction when there is this psychological control of a victim? Do you have guys that you know are guilty, but then the witnesses change their mind and you just can't get anything to stick?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, yes, absolutely that happens. Again, my goal is always to never have to have that victim. There's a multitude of evidence that we can collect in these cases, digital evidence, things from the internet, surveillance videos, so on and so forth. That is what we labor over, is to collect that evidence to hopefully not need the victim. But yes, absolutely, that does
Thank happen. Thank you. I have some questions for the Attorney General.
Mr. Chairman.
We heard a bill in committee a couple days ago that raised the fine to $400,000 for trafficking. Any conflict with you on that bill?
None whatsoever, Mr. Chairman. I mean, we came in and supported that bill, supported what the good senator was doing there. I think that's another great approach to this. We're trying to strongly discourage this behavior in Montana.
Okay. Another issue, effective date. Didn't see one on here. Would you like an immediate effective date?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, we will work on that. Senator Gross.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If the Attorney General would like to answer some of my questions, that
Senator.
Would be wonderful. Okay, so I didn't spend hours on the bill like my colleague over there, but I really appreciate the bill. I have, and if you want to grab a copy of the bill, I have some kind of specific questions. Thanks.
I don't have one, but I'll...
Okay. Mr. Chair, Mr. Attorney General, on page 15 on section 7, we're looking at limitations. And so on subsection C there on line 10, do I understand correctly that we're doing away with a statute of limitations for victims of trafficking who were less than 18 years old?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Gross, I would need to cross-reference those. I have not looked at this bill in quite a little while, but that looks to be correct.
Okay. Mr. Chair, may I follow up?
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Attorney General, thank you. That was my second question. Are we the stricken statutes in that subsection, are those, I'm thinking that those are probably, we're renumbering there? Sorry, that's a little bit of a technical question. And we can go back to that. Can you talk to me, let's go to the labor trafficking section on page 21. I don't think that anyone mentioned labor trafficking. Can you talk about the significance of that? How prevalent is in Montana is it, and how is it tied into human trafficking?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Gross, and this is probably something that Agent Yednak can elaborate on, but certainly not as prevalent as the sex trafficking, but yes, we do see labor trafficking cases. We have a number of them ongoing investigations. And again, I don't want to give too many details about something that's ongoing, but we have seen a couple fairly sophisticated labor trafficking investigations where people have been brought in, foreign nationals typically brought in, held in deplorable living situations, paid far below prevailing wage, made to pay for living in someone's closet, made to pay for renting tools to do their job. It's slavery, folks. I mean, that's what this is. They are coercing these people to work and live in subhuman standards at the threat of, oh, you don't want to do that? Well, that's fine. I'll call INS on you. That's coercion, no different than any other. So, again, long answer, Senator, but I would say not as prevalent as the sexual human trafficking, but we certainly do see these cases in Montana.
Sure. And may I follow up with Mr. Yadnick? Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Yadnick, for coming and appearing today, helping us understand this issue. Mr. Chair and Mr. Yadnick, I'm curious, is the labor trafficking, is it often tied into these narcotic and human trafficking investigations as well? Do you find these are often linked, or is this an issue that's kind of separate?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Gross, yes and no. Typically, labor trafficking cases exist in industries such as our tourist industry. We see them within our salons, both massage parlors as well as, and I'm speaking about illicit massage parlors, as well as nail salons. We'll then see it within hotels. We've seen it on our ranches. Areas like that, it is not needed for the drugs always to be that factor that's being held over the victims or used to maintain their existence. Oftentimes, as the Attorney General alluded to, it's that deportation because they're here illegally. So they're not as prevalent in labor trafficking cases that we find as in commercial sex trafficking cases.
Thank you. And one last question, please, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Mr. Yadnick, thank you very much. I appreciate the sort of paradigm shift and your commitment and the AG office's commitment to sort of shifting this perception that we have of victims of trafficking. And I want to talk about prostitution. Thank you for saying you've grown to loathe the term. I seem to remember maybe in 2017 or 19 as we've worked on this issue that we enhanced a penalty for prostitution, but it was explained in a way that it was necessary. So can you just tell me, is there anything in this bill that deals specifically with the crime of prostitution? I see on page 20 of the bill there is a definition. And what do we intend to do with the? I think that it's still on the books as a crime. How does the bill attempt to destigmatize that and ensure that people are not being prosecuted for prostitution when they are actually victims?
Chairman, Senator Gross, I believe within the bill, and maybe Mr. Kaczynski would be better to speak to this, but there is cause in which a victim, if they are proved to be a victim of trafficking, cannot be prosecuted for prostitution. But again, I would defer to Mr. Kaczynski, perhaps, for a further explanation of that.
Mr. Kaczynski? Yep. Need the question restated?
Chairman Rieger. Okay. No, thank you. Chairman Rieger, Senator Gross. There is an affirmative defense that somebody's charged with the misdemeanor offense of prostitution, that if they were a victim of sex trafficking, that would be an affirmative defense that would alleviate them of any criminal responsibility in that crime. We did increase penalties for prostitution, and I think, as A.G. Knudsen said, to really combat the demand for this, prostitution was a misdemeanor, and now it's a felony. And that's an important statement that this legislature will make, is that if you go forward with prostitution, we're not going to treat it as a misdemeanor offense in Montana. We would treat it as a felony offense. It doesn't have any mandatory minimums or anything like that, but the maximum penalty would be a five-year maximum penalty, which is a low maximum penalty in Montana. But there's no minimum. Judges, I suspect, would be doing deferred impositions and suspended sentences for people that are charged with patrons of prostitution. We did increase if you're involved in prostitution with a child, it is what is commonly referred to as a Jessica's Law sentence. There is strict liability, too. If you are a patron of prostitution and you go out and seek women and you are with somebody that's under the age of 18, regardless if you knew it or not, it will be a Jessica's Law sentence. These are children. And if you play with that type of situation because of your interest in young people, it's strict. You cannot come to court and say, I did not know she was 18, or excuse me, 17, 16, 15. She told me the wrong age. It will keep patrons away from our children, and that's why that's designed. And there's this express language in the bill that says that there's strict liability, that we needed to put in the bill to say that a strict liability under those circumstances.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Kaczynski. Can you just tell me how many prosecutions has the state pursued for prostitution, prosecutions for prostitution, since that law was changed?
So currently, it's a misdemeanor to engage with to be a patron of a prostitute. How many of those cases are tried by the folks at DCI? Mr. Yadnak, speak to that. Would that be okay?
Go ahead.
Yeah. Senator Gross, I believe there may be some confusion, and correct me if I'm wrong, but are you speaking to the proposition of prostitution or the act of prostitution by a victim?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Yadnak, thanks for helping me kind of clarify my own question and thoughts on this. I guess I'm speaking to someone who maybe is not working with a, maybe they are, maybe they are not working with a pimp, but for I'm just going to use women because I think that's how it typically happens, for a woman who, are women being charged with prostitution? I'm not speaking of the patron side of it, but the person performing the act.
Okay. Mr. Chair, Senator Gross, to answer that question, since I have led this unit, we have not charged a single female with prostitution. That is something that we take a pretty hard stance against, I say at the state level. I can think of one instance in a case that I worked where a woman was charged with trafficking at the federal level, but she was trafficking a juvenile female as well as prostituting herself from a different state here into Montana.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Weber.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sir, I did get your real name. Mr. Chair, sir, I was looking at the fiscal note, and I was seeing that, and there's no one here from the Department of Corrections, but is this when the Attorney General had spoken that the human trafficking cases rose 871%? Is this really a conservative guess on how much it would be if, say, all these cases are being prosecuted and then we have to incarcerate them for 25 to 100 years? Is this pretty conservative or is it spot on?
I would have to defer to the Attorney General, perhaps, for that, ma'am.
Thank you. Refer.
Go ahead. Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Weber, thank you for the question, and I do appreciate being able to clarify this. We've actually prepared a rebuttal through the Department of Justice to the Department of Corrections fiscal note on this. We do not agree with it. I do think we'll probably see some increased prosecutions, but I think Department of Corrections fiscal note is a little on the aggressive side. We've got a copy of this rebuttal. I don't know if you've all been provided with that rebuttal.
It was handed out this morning. Senator Weber, did you get a copy?
I did, Mr. Chair. I just didn't look at it. Thank you.
Okay.
I think we're going to see a big deterrent effect. I just don't think we're going to see the impact to DOC that they are proposing. Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Thank you, Attorney General.
Senator Kelker.
Another question for the AG, please.
Mr. Chair, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. I noticed that there were some pretty significant amendments coming out of the House. Two persons have been working on those things. Is that in? Are you working with them, or is this something that you're not in favor of?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Kelker, I honestly couldn't tell you what the status of those amendments were. I know we had a number of proponents in the House committee. I honestly don't know if those amendments got put on or if the committee opted not to do that. I mean, as you know, once it comes to the House, it's no longer our bill. It's their baby. So I apologize, Senator, but I truly don't know what the status of those amendments were, if they were even put on.
Follow up, please. It would be helpful if you could tell us where those things stand, because there's a lot of language there. It's hard for us to know how it's fitting with your ideas. So could you get back to us before
Sure.
we're doing our taking action?
Absolutely, Senator Kelker, Mr. Chairman. Obviously, we're still in support of the bill and in whatever shape it came out of the House in. It came out of the House unanimously. We're very thrilled about that. Hopeful for the same treatment over here. But yes, we can certainly, that will not be difficult to find out if it was amended. Senator.
Any other questions? Senator Heimbach.
Mr. Chair, maybe we should talk to the sponsor about the House amendments.
Go ahead, Senator.
Can you respond to that question, or Mr. Chair? Senator Representative Shard, can you respond to that question about the amendments?
Mr. Chair and Senator Heimbach, so some of the amendments that came through, they just were language that just wasn't quite cleaned up in the code in order to match some of the sections, because all of these things moved the crimes from section 600 to 700. So in just moving those crimes over, that's why we do this. We have 500 or 150 pairs of eyes on this. So we just cleaned up a little bit of language to make sure that that was consistent over the codes, and so they were all friendly. We worked with the Department of Justice to get that done.
Senator Usher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Real quick for the sponsor. First question is, you don't hear of any more amendments that anybody's thinking about, correct?
Mr. Chair and Senator Usher, no, sir.
Follow-up.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Representative, based on the date of the rebuttal for the fiscal note, this actually did make it through appropriations with this fiscal note, correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator Usher, it did or didn't?
It did.
Did it?
Yes.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Seeing none, Representative, you may close on your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I just want to start this close with a little story. In researching human sex trafficking in the state of Montana and working with the DOJ's office, hearing stories about convictions, I want to tell you a little bit about how these traffickers target our young boys and girls. So for legislators, for all you senators, and for parents, and for our youth that we have in the gallery today, I want to tell you that this is what they do to traffic our children. They go to the mall or ball games or other places where children hang out, and they are very smart about what they do. These people that traffic, they're not dumb. These people are ready to do and target our young children. So they'll find a child that maybe is alone, and they'll go and sit down next to that child, and they'll talk to that child. And one of the prior persons who was convicted of this said that as he's talking to that child, he's getting a feel for it, and he'll look at them and say some simple compliment like, oh, you've got such beautiful eyes. And if that child answers, thank you, that person walks away. If the child says, oh, no, I don't, and shows that they might not have the self-esteem, that child is trafficked. I want you guys to remember that, what happens. Stick up for each other, take care of each other, and remember that these people that are traffickers target our children. So I urge you on this committee to remember, not in our state. This law spells it out. We can't allow this. Thank you for your time, and I urge a due pass.
This ends the hearing on House Bill 112. Next, we'll open the hearing on Senate Bill 256. Senator, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, Senator Carl Glimm from Senate District 2, GLIMM. Well, you read the title of this bill, Prohibit Ownership of Montana Land by Foreign Adversary Governments, you might think, oh, this is super timely. I just want to take us back a little bit to before Montana was even a state. Foreign ownership was an issue as Montana mining was going from placer mining to industrial mining. There was lots and lots of investment from foreign governments, particularly England in London. That actually spurred the federal government to pass the Territorial Alien Land Act, in which territorial lands were not able to be owned by foreign governments. So now we speed up just a little bit to maybe a year, year and a half ago, and we start hearing some rumors of some foreign governments owning land in Montana and across the nation in relationship to military installations. And then we can even fast forward to just last week, as China is floating a balloon over our very own state and Malmstrom Air Force Base, and this becomes very real, very pertinent, very fast. So I want to talk kind of in generalities, because I had a little lawyer help yesterday, and we have an amendment coming to make this bill much stronger. But it doesn't change the intent of what I want to do with this bill. So the intent is to not allow foreign governments who are adversarial governments, and that is on page 2, we have a list of who we call out, but we want to be able to make sure that that can be changed. So we're gonna change that language just a little bit there, but we're referencing the U.S. code of where they call out foreign adversary governments. But right now, in particular, it's China, Cuba, Iran, North Korea, Russia, Venezuela. So what we don't want those governments or any faction of that. So at the top of that page 2, we also talk about the foreign government, the foreign non-government person, including citizens. We don't want them to be able to have somebody that they're controlling just going out and buying that land on their behalf. And so that's going to get very difficult, because I have heard just in this last week where some of those governments are going out and finding people from other countries to come in, buy land, and still control it. But we're going to try and get some language that will tighten that up, too. And then toward the end of the bill, we talk about what we're going to do with people that own land now. So if foreign adversarial governments or citizens of those governments own land now, we don't want that to continue either. So this is another portion of the amendment. What I had in here is eminent domain
that we would take that land from them. What we're going to do is add in another faction of that, kind of more of a foreclosure process, and keep the eminent domain so that there's two options to go about that. We're also going to assign that to a state agency, and I'm thinking that's probably going to be at the AG's office to handle that. So there are a few things that we're cleaning up in the amendment to make it a little bit tighter bill, make it work just a little bit better. But the general idea is that we want to be able to have some national security in the state of Montana, and that's very important. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
Any proponents? Senate Bill 256 in the room. Proponents? Any proponents in the room? We have one online, Cheryl Tuscan.
Hello, Mr. Chair. Can you hear me okay?
Very good. Go ahead.
Awesome. Well, I just wanted to say thank you, Steve, for taking this bill up. I just want to start by saying that it's important for us to be honest about our foreign adversaries. China has been in unrestricted warfare with us for years, while the U.S. federal government waved it all away and told us that China is our friend. So I just wanted to examine some of the details. That the Chinese Communist Party officials have boasted that they have compromised our leaders in the U.S. government. The CCP and affiliate business entities own more American farmland than U.S. farmers. They own 80% of the world's antibiotic supply, and some of our advanced weapon systems have been contracted by the U.S. military to be built and manufactured in China. We even import over 300,000 Chinese students every year into our universities, while the U.S. turns a blind eye when they return to China with intellectual property and research that they turn around and use against us. The most shocking to me is seeing the NBA and Hollywood scramble to apologize to the CCP for saying something critical of their dictatorship or something basic like, I stand with Hong Kong. Chinese businesses own the majority of our meatpacking plants in the U.S., and the CCP have stated numerous times that they are at war with America. The Epoch Times has excellent reporting on their unrestricted warfare and long-term plans against the U.S. So as the federal government seems compromised by the CCP, states must act now to protect their citizens when federal government will not. 12 other states have passed legislation barring foreign adversaries from purchasing and owning land. And I just want to encourage you guys to be prudent and wise and protect our greatest commodity, which is our food, production, and land. And so I ask for a due pass. Thank you.
Any other proponents? Seeing none, we'll go to opponents. Any opponents in the room? Opponents? Seeing none, there are none online. Informational witness? Any informational witness? None. Questions from the committee? Senator Weber?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the sponsor, please.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Weber.
Mr. Chair, Senator Glimm, I just want to know, how's this going to be enforced? Should it pass?
The enforcement, we're going to have run that through the Attorney General's office. So they're going to be able to, if one was to, the existing, if somebody owns it now, it would be through a foreclosure process or through eminent domain, either of those options.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
Thank you. On the fiscal note, at the bottom of the page, it said technical notes, and it says currently there's no mechanism in the DNRC to know if the water rights customer is a citizen or enemy of the state. Water Resource Division is not able to enforce this bill. Do you have any suggestions on that? How? Because water rights right now is becoming an issue, and if we can't enforce it, then do you have any suggestions on how we can?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Weber, actually, until Well, actually, until you just mentioned it, and I did read the technical notes, but I was thinking that that's not very applicable. But water rights and title for land can be separated, so maybe we should look at that, too, to make sure that we're connecting them both. But there is, so to, I think to get back to a little bit more of your question is, How do we know who is owning that? So it's self-reported. It's a federal law that these adversarial governments or citizens of that self-report. It's widely expected, and I would expect too. It is very underreported. So it's going to be difficult. It's going to be difficult to figure out who are the foreign adversaries that own land in Montana. But hopefully the Attorney General's office can work at it. Maybe if citizens are suspect, they can look in and it's title work is public, all public documents. So it gives an opportunity for that end of things if citizens want to start looking in and trying to help and figure that out. This just would give a mechanism to prohibit it, and if they do own it, to get it out of their ownership.
One follow-up, last follow-up.
Go ahead.
Senator, on the technical note as well, it says a comprehensive database of lands and property interests. Will you be working with the State Library and the Montana Cadastral? They keep a extensive database on that, and if so, would it reflect in a new fiscal note?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Weber, I don't know that. I think how the GIS could be useful in that is that it is a resource to look and see who those owners are. I don't think there's any mechanism where they would have to list on the GIS what their citizenry is. So that's not a function of it. It would kind of be an ancillary. You would have to go and find that out separate from the GIS. The GIS will give you who the owner of the parcel is.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator, I have a question. Line 22, page 1, it doesn't apply to the Indian tribes. So does that mean they can sell their land? But that's federal land, isn't it? And then that makes me wonder, how about federal forest, BLM land?
Mr. Chairman, the intent there is that that we're not calling out the tribes as being foreign governments.
Okay. Got it. Okay. Thank you. Senator Gross.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. Senator Glimm, I apologize. I had to step out for just a moment when you opened.
Missed my history lesson.
Shoot. Maybe we can get a recap later. Mr. Chair, Senator Glimm, I see that there's some federal legislation out there now, some bipartisan federal legislation dealing with the same issue. But the one thing that I see in your bill that I haven't actually looked at the piece of legislation that is now being discussed in Congress, but yours prohibits a foreign adversary government and citizens of that foreign government. And then I saw on page 2 on the first line, so we're going to define a foreign adversary government means a foreign government or a foreign non-government person, including citizens of the foreign government. And I'm just curious, what is your thinking there, and how? What do we see in Montana? Are governmental entities buying up land, or is it just citizens? Like, can you explain that to me?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Gross, yes. So it... if we just limited it to foreign government, that would be very easy for them to subvert that. So one of the examples that I heard of someone buying land was actually an ex-military ranking officer, no longer in the Chinese government, but ex-military officer was going out and buying land. Well, doesn't take you very long to figure out what that's about. I mean, it's the same thing. So all they're trying to do is get around actually the government being the one to buy it. And that's why we need to open that up just a little bit. We need to make sure that we're casting a broad net to catch all those ways that they're going to figure out to try and find a loophole.
Follow up?
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Glenn, I appreciate your answer. Yeah, that makes sense to me. I'm curious, though, if there might be any instances where we had someone who was here with a green card, or where they were here for a longer period of time and they were on a path to citizenship. Do you intend for this bill to apply to any person from one of these nations listed here in the bill, or can you speak to that, please?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Gross, yes, that is my intent.
Okay. All
and right. I realize that there may be someone who is not necessarily buying land for that intent, but it's not like we're just ripping the land out from them either. They're going to be compensated fair market value so that we don't have a takings clause. And it doesn't mean that they can't still live here if they want to. They could rent. We just aren't going to allow them to own property.
Thank you for clarifying. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the sponsor. Mr. Chair, Senator, I guess I want to follow up on the previous questioning. If a permanent resident who has a green card is living in this country from these countries, they're just as likely to be here because they can't live in those countries anymore because they're friends of ours. Is that not as likely to be true as that they're here on behalf of China to buy up land?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, that is possible. You're right.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
Senator Glimm, I'd like to ask you if I would like to amend out, including citizens of the foreign government. I understand you want to catch a broad net, but at this point, permanent residents are legally entitled to buy land. They're considered to be in this country for a reason. There's a lot of other processes that people have to go through before they get a green card. And I just think this broad net is way too broad, particularly when many of the people living here from these countries are here specifically because of their relationships with their home governments. So I think that the intent goes way too far when you include citizens. I understand what you're saying when you're talking about the government buying it or getting around it by having people create other legal entities, but I think this borders on a real discrimination, and I'm just wondering if you'd be okay with the amendment.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, I would not.
Thank you,
Senator Friedel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is for the sponsor. Mr. Chairman, Senator Glimm, say somebody comes here from an enemy state, becomes a citizen, a U.S. citizen, and they own or purchase property in the United States, will your bill adversely affect those people?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Friedel, not if they're a citizen here.
Thank you.
Senator Kelker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A question for the sponsor. When you were putting together this bill, which is actually pretty complicated, I think, did you look at other states to see how they had tackled all of these questions about enemy states?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Kelker, we did reference other states and looked at other states when we were putting this together, and are continuing to look at that for the amendment. Probably the biggest takeaway I found in that was that almost all other states are specifically looking at agricultural land. Mm-hmm. And I thought it was just as important for residential land because You could buy a house right next door to Maelstrom, and you're doing the exact same thing. I opened it up to all land, not just agricultural land.
Follow-up, please.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Senator, you are still kind of in action on this and want to do some amending. Am I hearing that correctly?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Kelker, yes, that is correct.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Seeing none, Senator, you may close on your bill.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you very much for a good hearing, good questions. I look forward to presenting you with an amendment that will make this bill even better, but I think it's time for Montana to stand up. Thank you.
This ends the hearing on Senate Bill 256. Next, we'll open the hearing on Senate Bill 252. Senator, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Greg Hertz, Senate District 6. Glad to be back here again. Today I bring a bill that basically revises a code of ethics for elected officials, including judicial officers. So it's really a pretty simple bill. If you go to page 2 of the bill, on line 5, we're just going to basically define that a local government, that term doesn't include district court judges, although people sometimes think of them as a part of the local government, they're really not. And then also we go over to page 3, the bulk of the bill. It basically defines a state officer. That also includes all judicial officers, justices, district court judges, and judges of the judicial branch of state government. And then if you go to page 4, section 4, this is a section that deals with the Commission of Political Practices. So basically in there, it basically says now also judicial officers are subject to rules when it involves campaign practices. So that's basically all this bill does. It pulls in judicial officers just like all other state employees, state elected officials, into campaign finance laws. So if you're violating any of those campaign finance laws, then those complaints go to the Commission of Political Practices. The violations of judicial standards that a judge might be subject to still go to the Judicial Standards Review Commission. So I think this is a common sense law, and today I think my normal opponents are going to come and support this bill. Thank you.
Proponents. Wow.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. It does give me great pleasure to appear on behalf of the Montana Judges Association in support of 100% of Hertz's bill. This day may be just as momentous as yesterday when Senator Manzella and I agreed. it's going to be short-lived, Senator, yeah. So the judges appreciate the senator's thoughtful approach to this bill and in recognizing that...
Mr. Chair, point Senator, of order. The gentleman speaking did not tell us who he was in the session.
Name is Bruce Spencer, S-P-E-N-C-E-R, and I represent the Montana Judges Association today. My apologies.
That's what happens when you're so excited about being a proponent.
I'm so excited to be a proponent. We appreciate the sponsor's thoughtful approach to the regulation in this bill and in recognizing that indeed it is the Judicial Standards Commission that handles complaints about judicial conduct. And we feel that this bill is a fair application, and that's why we can support it. Thank you.
Any other proponents in the room? Proponents? Seeing none, there are none online. How about opponents? Any opponents in the room? Informational witnesses? Questions from the committee? Senator Olson.
Thank you. A question for the sponsor, please.
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hertz, I'm looking at page 7, 9 to 11, the severability clause. I often only see a severability clause in a bill when there's been indications that it might have a constitutional conflict issue of some sort. Did you receive any legal review note? I know we don't have a legal note on this case, on this bill, but did you receive anything that would explain why there needed to be a severability clause?
Mr. Chair, Senator, no, I did not, and I believe any legal notes are now posted on our website if you want to find them, but I did not receive any.
Any other questions?
I'll follow up with the...
Go ahead.
With Ms. Krasowski, please. Mr. Chair, Ms. Krasowski, why would there need to be a severability clause in this bill?
So the purpose of a severability clause is if part of an act is declared unconstitutional or if the application of an act in one instance is declared unconstitutional, to preserve the remaining parts of the act. So it would be put in there to state what the legislative intent was if part of the act was found to be unconstitutional or unconstitutional under a particular set of circumstances. So it lets the courts know what the legislature's intent is, not that the whole bill fails.
Thank you. Follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
Thank you. Ms. Krasowski, is it possible that we can get a copy of the legal note to file? I know there's not a legal note on it, but whatever the legal review note to file was on this?
I can look in the file and see if there is anything. I don't know that there's anything in the file.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator, I've kind of viewed that severability kind of like an insurance policy. If there's something that might come up, and I don't know, it could be on every bill that we pass. Senator Gross?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think Senator Hertz wants to speak to this issue again. Go ahead, Senator.
Sure, Mr. Chair, members of the body, yes. I mean, I think the chairman pointed out precisely. I mean, there are times in many different bills we have severability clauses, you know, just kind of as an insurance policy in case we get to the court and something goes sideways and we didn't see everything that might have been in the bill. We don't want to bring it all down.
And Mr. Chair, Senator Hertz, my question is, I know I've seen the new commissioner wandering around the third floor quite a bit this week. I think he has his confirmation hearing this week. Have you worked with the commissioner's office, either the previous or the new commissioner of political practices, and do they have an opinion on this lying within
their purview? Mr. Chair, Senator Gross, no, I did not. This bill didn't come from him, or I don't even believe I ran this bill past him today. I was hoping that the office might be here today to answer any potential questions, but I guess they're not here. So,
all right. Mr. Chair, we'll probably try to follow up there. And
sure.
Thank you.
Okay. Senator Usher.
Thank you, Mr. Spencer. Mr. Chair.
Go ahead, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Spencer, my understanding is you came in that the Judges Association was for this bill?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, that's correct.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Follow up.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Spencer, in the past you've testified that the Judges Association has a group, that like a legislative group that you go to be for or against bills. Is that still the case?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, I'm happy to explain what happens. There is a group of, I think, 7 judges that are sort of an executive committee, and we review bills, and then they instruct me what position to take on bills.
Thank you. Follow-up?
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Spencer, can you tell us who those judges are?
Off the top of my head, I should grab my phone. I have a text string. I can do that if I grab my phone with my text string. I could tell you that the president is Judge Leslie Halligan in Missoula, Judge Peter Ullman in Bozeman is on the committee. Judge Luke Berger from Dillon is on the committee. Judge Cuffey from Libby is on the committee. Judge Farr from Billings is on the committee. Chief Judge McGrath is on the committee. Am I missing some? I'm sure I am. That's from memory. I could grab my phone and look at my text string.
If you could get back to us on that last one, I would appreciate it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
One more? Is that what I need?
You did pretty good.
You did pretty good.
Any other questions? Senator Gross.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and for the sponsor again. Sorry, Mr. Chair, Senator Hertz, I just thought of this. We don't have a fiscal note, so I'm not sure how many complaints may go to the Commissioner of Political Practices, but do you think, have you requested a fiscal note, or should there be one, since this would it probably or may increase the workload of the COPP?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I didn't request a fiscal note. I don't believe this should have a large impact. I don't see a lot of complaints coming forth. I mean, the Judges Association is supporting this bill, as any elected officials. I think most of us are all aware of, you know, campaign finance laws, and I'm sure our judges will continue to follow those, and hopefully there won't be any complaints at all.
Thank you.
Senator Weber.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For Mr. Spencer, please.
Mr. Chair, Senator.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Spencer, does the judges have a code of ethics already?
Mr. Chair, Senator, absolutely. There's the judicial code of conduct that judges are required to file, and if there's violations of that, they are handled by the Judicial Standards Commission. This would be in addition to some of those requirements.
Follow up.
Go ahead.
Do they complement one another, this code of ethics for elected officials and judges and the existing code of ethics for the judges at this time?
Chair Regeer, Senator, I really do think this is involved more in campaign finance and gifts, so there are some different subjects that are addressed by the Judicial Code of Conduct in this bill.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Spencer.
Do you have the last name?
If I may.
Go ahead.
I do love being old in my memory. Mike Manahan from Helena is also on the committee, Senator. Thank you.
All right. Any other questions? Seeing none, Senator, you may close on your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman of the committee. I think all of us want to follow ethics laws in the state, and we got to make sure that if you violate those, particularly campaign finance laws, there's a place for the citizens and other individuals to go. I'm glad I could bring a bill here today that we can all agree on. I would request a due pass, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
This ends the hearing on Senate Bill 252. Next, we'll open the hearing on House Bill 205. Representative, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chairman Regeer, members of the committee, my name is Fred Anderson. Last name spelled A-N-D-E-R-S-O-N. I represent House District 20 in Great Falls. I'm pleased to bring House Bill 205 to you today for your consideration. This bill addresses a significant increase in both the value of new and used vehicles as well as the increase in the cost of repairs, primarily in body shops. I contacted a couple of body shops here in Helena and inquired about the increases they'd had in the last couple of years in shop costs, and they said they've gone up about 20 to 25% since 2020 because of supply chain issues and labor costs. This bill changes the minimum liability coverage because of injury to or destruction of property of others in any one accident from $20,000 to $50,000. this actually, if you think about it, is a consumer protection bill. If you're in an accident and are deemed at fault, in which the property damage to the other's vehicle exceeds $20,000 and your insurance coverage has that amount as its maximum, your personal assets become in jeopardy. Mr. Chair, I'll just sit now and allow any proponents and opponents, but I'd like to reserve the right to close if I may.
Any proponents in the room? Proponents.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Frank Cote, C-O-T-E, representing the Commissioner of Securities and Insurance. Mr. Chairman, all too often in our office, we get calls from consumers who may have been injured or had their vehicles damaged or something. And unfortunately, the current coverage that the other person may be carrying isn't enough to pay for that damage, and then they end up having to place it on their own insurance, and they just don't feel that is fair. And we just believe it's time to raise that limit, and so we support this bill. Thank you.
Any other proponents in the room?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, Dwayne Williams, W-I-L-L-I-A-M-S, and I'm the Executive Director for the Montana Trucking Association. We also are supportive of this bill. If a truck or if a car pushes a truck off the road, you can just blink twice and it almost costs more than $20,000 depending on how the wreck, just to get that truck back up on the road and then all the damage after that. So I know I've had some members that have asked for this, so thank you.
Any other proponents in the room? There are none online. How about opponents? Any opponents?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Amy Grimolis. It's G-R-M-O-L-J-E-Z, and I rise today on behalf of the American Property and Casualty Insurance Association. We are the umbrella group for property and casualty insurance across America. We have 80% of the members that insure folks across America, and so I wanted to share that with you because we typically don't come to Senate Judiciary, so it's a pleasure to be here for APCIA. We rise as opponents to this bill, mostly, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, to say that we think it's actually too high. I've talked to the bill sponsor about this. If this passes, the $50,000 number will make Montana twice as high as every other state in America. The other states, and I know there's a chart that will be passed out later, the coverage for property and casualty auto insurance is $25,000, $20,000, $15,000, and below. The reason why is that most folks that when you get auto insurance in this regard, it's really to, if you kind of look up the definition, it says that liability coverage in this regard is important to help protect for bodily injury and property damage when there is an injury related to your vehicle. So that is the public policy purpose in having this type of insurance, and Montana law requires that. And the argument is, well, $20,000 isn't enough anymore to pay for a car if it gets wrecked. And I think I would answer that's correct. But what we want to make sure is that people aren't just disregarding the law and failing to get that type of insurance. So our concern is that for those of our Montana residents who might be paycheck to paycheck and questioning about whether or not they really need to get this insurance or just pay the fine if they're in an accident, we want them to continue to get this type of coverage. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, as I said, we'd be hopeful if this bill could be amended to a lower amount, to the $25,000 versus $50,000, but until that time, we would stand as opponents. Thank you.
Any other opponents?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Greg Van Horsen. That's capital V-A-N, capital H-O-R-S-S-E-N. I stand before you this morning representing State Farm Insurance Company, and this is indeed my first opportunity to address you folks today. And over the span of 4 decades now, this is the latest that I've ever made an initial appearance before this committee. So I'll introduce myself in the hallways as I can. Mr. Chairman, I have a handout, if I may.
That'd be fine. Give it to the secretary.
Mr. Chairman, what I just handed out is a state-by-state analysis of liability coverages, minimum liability coverages for each state. There's three numbers in that line, and I think most everybody's familiar with what those numbers stand for. With the exception of Florida, there's three numbers in that line. The first number is if you're liable for an automobile accident, and there are injuries, then that is the limit per person. The second number is the limit per accident, the total limit of coverage that would be available. And the third number, which is the number we're addressing today, is the property damage number. And if you move down the list, you'll see that Montana's current minimum is $25,000 per person, $50,000 per accident, and then on property damage, as the sponsor has indicated, it is $20,000 in Montana. State Farm stands in opposition to this bill, primarily, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, because you are being asked to raise that property damage coverage by more than half in Montana, or more than double in Montana, and exactly double the highest property damage limit in the nation. And in doing so, you'll also be raising the cost of the minimum coverage legally available in Montana. And that's important to State Farm because State Farm wants to make sure, and I think we all do, and this is the balancing act you all will be doing here today, we all want to make sure everybody has some liability coverage just in case they're in an at-fault accident. State Farm generally opposes mandatory minimums simply because we believe everybody is different, and certainly there are different financial means for everyone in the state. We believe that coverage should be the result of a candid, reasoned conversation between an insurance professional and the individual, wherein they discuss, importantly, financial wherewithal to afford and provide the adequate coverage for yourself and your family. Most everybody here in this room, I would assume, agrees that the minimums, the statutory minimums that I just handed out, that's not enough. But it's, frankly, all that some people can afford. Likely the folks that have that basic minimum of coverage in any one of those states, many of those folks simply can't afford anything more than that. Now to my point. I just looked this morning nationwide just for a layout of percentage of uninsured motorists in various states. Right now, best guess from insure.com, I think it was the website I was on, right now 10% of Montanans are uninsured. That's no coverage. That's no liability coverage for injuries, and that's no property damage coverage. House Bill 205 will indeed raise the property damage coverage minimum, but it will also raise the price of auto insurance. Doesn't seem like a lot of money. I'll give you the numbers from our perspective. In State Farm's case, their best guess, and some will be higher, some will be lower, for our low-risk drivers, which is the mutual company, it will be roughly $15 a year. But for our higher-risk folks that are in a substandard company, it will be somewhere in that $30 a year premium increase. Doesn't seem like a lot. I understand that. But it will be enough, we believe, to move some people into the uninsured category, which I think is the hard piece for a bill like this. We believe, as a previous opponent mentioned, that maybe a more reasoned approach to this bill and to this issue, as the committee addresses this, a more reasoned approach might be to bring Montana up to the highest property damage minimum limit in the country, which is $25,000. And the highest one I can find on this list is $30,000. No, maybe not. I think it's $25,000. So that would be commensurate with the highest property damage limit minimum in the country. We think that may be a reasoned approach. We know that it will be a smaller increase just by virtue of our company's exposure and the like. I have spoken with the sponsor about this, and I just want to go on record as saying we would be willing to work with the sponsor for a more modest amendment. With that, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I thank you for your time, and I'm available for questions.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Bruce Spencer, S-P-E-N-C-E-R, today representing the National Association of Mutual Insurance Carriers. Those are companies that have their members as owners, and some of them are smaller insurance companies that right here in Montana. NAMIC shares Mr. Van Orson's concerns about costs, and interestingly, over many studies, it's been shown that if you raise the required minimums for insurance, you get less compliance with the required minimum insurance law. So by raising the rate, the amounts required, less people will purchase insurance, and so you have a greater uninsured problem. So that's NAMIC's major concern. And just so you know, what happens when that happens is that because you're going to have more uninsured motorist claims on those people that have coverage for uninsured motorists, you can buy that on your policy, and I'll give you a little tip. I think you all should. But that raises the rate for everyone else on that particular policy because you've got more uninsured. So I get it. It's a chicken and egg sort of thing. What are you going to do? We would agree with Mr. Van Horsen's approach that this is a little bit too much. And if you need to raise the rate, a more modest increase would be more appropriate. Thank you.
Any other opponents in the room? Opponents? How about informational witnesses? Seeing none, questions from the committee. Senator Weber.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For Mr. Orson.
Mr. Chairman, Senator.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Orson, I just paid my insurance, and there's an uninsured driver. Will that affect the rest of us? Will that cost more for us that have to cover uninsured drivers?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Weber, the rate that you're paying for any coverage on your insurance policy is based upon that company's experience with losses in that particular area. So to answer your question, if there are more uninsured or underinsured motorists in the state, but in this case, uninsured motorists in the state, by virtue of the minimums costing just enough that there are more uninsured people, and if those number of claims go up, and the magnitude of those claims goes up, you'll see an upward push in that particular rate. So the answer to your question is more uninsured people, probably higher rate for your uninsured motorist, part of your premium.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Van Horsen, while you're there, do you have any idea on the average cost of a new car?
I do not, Mr. No. Chairman. I'm sorry.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Friedel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This would be for Mr. Van Horsen.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Friedel.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Van Horsen. I was trying to keep you from doing leg days. Sorry. So you espouse to, if this were to be enacted with the $50,000, that the increase to this particular insurance policy would be $15 to $30 a year, correct?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, that is my client's estimate.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Van Horsen, so if it were to be amended to be a move to the at least at the highest of the nation via $25,000, give or take, what would be the cost increase on that bump?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, that is a good question. I have not analyzed that. You can rest assured it will be less than the figure that I advanced for the $30,000 figure.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Van Horsen, if you can find that out from your the people you represent to get that information to us, to kind of give us a guideline of maybe what this would look like difference-wise, I'd appreciate it.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, my client is watching this hearing right now, and consequently they're acting upon it as we speak.
Thank you, sir.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to ask a question of Frank Cody, Commissioner Cody. From the Commissioner's office, please. What is this title?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Cody, I want to follow up on what I, as a purchaser of insurance, can do to protect myself when people are uninsured or underinsured. We heard testimony already today, I think, from including you, that most people, even if they have insurance coverage, don't have enough. And can you tell me how those two systems work and how we are protected under those two systems?
So, Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, let me start off by saying while I was sitting there, I did a quick Kelley Blue Book search of my 10-year-old pickup with 148,000 miles. And the value is very close to $20,000. And that's a 10-year-old pickup with 148,000 miles, okay? So to Mr. Chairman's question, I don't know the average price of a new car, but we have all seen some of the expenses of those new cars. Now, to get to your specific question, if you have uninsured motorist coverage, then that coverage will help pay for your loss, okay? You are paying more to have that coverage in your premium. Same is true with underinsured, okay? So if the policy limits stay as they are in statute today at $20,000 and you have a $50,000 car that gets totaled, okay, if you have underinsured motorist coverage that would help cover that, they would cover what the party that was the responsible party's insurance company didn't cover. But again, you are paying for that premium.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Go ahead.
And maybe we need Mr. Van Horsen's folks to listen to this question and get us the number. But I guess my question is that if I'm purchasing insurance, would it be cheaper for me to purchase uninsured motorist coverage and underinsured motorist coverage? Would it be cheaper for me as a purchaser of insurance to buy that rather than to buy insurance on an increased amount?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, if I understood your question correctly, you are inquiring whether the cost for you to purchase underinsured and uninsured motorist coverage would be roughly the same premium as the other person purchasing a higher minimum amount?
Yes. So if follow up, Mr. Chair?
Go ahead.
Yeah. So if I'm buying insurance and I have to pay more money because now we're raising the limit to $50,000, so I have to buy that $50,000 in case I hit somebody, and I'm covering their car for $50,000. But is it cheaper, rather than me covering their car for $50,000, that I buy and everybody buy uninsured motorist coverage and underinsured motorist coverage? Do we know if that's cheaper or about the same price?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, I'm going to leave that answer up to the actuaries at Mr. Van Horsen's company who are listening in, apparently, and because I would have no idea.
Okay, thank you. A follow-up question for the sponsor, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, I agree that the cost of repairs for cars has gone up, as well as the cost to purchase cars. But we also know that the cost for repairing bodies has gone up even higher than it does to repair a cost. And so I'm wondering if we're going to increase the rates. I noticed that we could actually increase the rate for destruction of bodily injury or death to the person I hit. If I unfortunately am the cause of an accident that harms somebody, I'd actually like myself, I mean, I purchased more than $50,000 because I'm very worried about, I wouldn't want to harm somebody and not be able to at least compensate them. So it feels a little cynical that we're raising the cost of insuring our cars, but we're not raising the amount that's available for bodily injury. And I'm wondering if you would be supportive of an amendment that raised that amount to $100,000, which is in line with at least a few other states. And if you had considered that or thought about it, and if you'd be opposed or supportive of it.
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, in fact, initially when I was preparing the bill, that was one of the things that was included in the bill. And one of the stipulations from the insurance carriers that I visited with, in fact, I naively thought I would increase it to 50-75, and they said, no, that's not the way we do business, because the second number actually involves more than one individual or more than one accident, it's at double, and so it'd be 50 and 100 if you used 50 as a baseline figure. But looking at it, and one of the arguments that the opponent said is to use a little caution so that you didn't raise the premiums enough that people would elect to not be insured. But as I understand the process, once this hearing is over, this bill will no longer belong to me. It'll belong to this committee. And if you seek amendments in the committee, and I'm agreeable to looking at any amendments you have, but I believe the bill at that point becomes the property of this committee, Senator Olson and Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative. Thank you, Mr.
Senator
Chair.
Senator Usher.
Mr. Chair, for Ms. Grimales.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Usher.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Grimales, in your testimony you mentioned that you were, if we raise this, would you all would be concerned that people would want to just pay the fine for not having the insurance. My question is, are you advocating to raise the fines for this, for not having insurance?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Usher, always a good question from you. I would have to ask if that would be our company's position. I think it makes sense if you're not complying with the law. And I think that right now our concern is that this bill would increase the number of folks that would be electing to not get that insurance level in Montana today. And that's what the data has shown across the country.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And we are straying from the bill, Senator. Any other questions? Okay. Seeing none, Representative, you may close on your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As has been mentioned a number of times, the minimum value of $20,000, which was last changed in 2017, is woefully inadequate in today's market. And I think one of the things that I would like to thank the opposition for is bringing this colorful chart that I think really reinforces the position I have on this bill.
one of the things that I think if you look at it, the cost is not very much. The two companies I happen to insure with two companies, and the six-month increase on the policies I have would run about $6, which is in line with what one of the opponents mentioned, who mentioned less than 15 per year. And I think any time you can buy $30,000 worth of coverage for less than $10 every 6 months, it's a pretty good bargain. But having said that, and Mr. Chair and committee, I understand that insurance bills like this are not typically heard in your committee, and so I appreciate you adding this to your workload and taking the time to hear this bill this morning. I would request that you vote a due pass on it and move it to the Senate floor. And as mentioned before, I would be happy to work with any of the opponents on amendments if that's the desire of the committee, Mr. Chair.
This ends a hearing on House Bill 205. You can carry it. I don't want to carry it. I'll kill it. Maybe kill it here. Committee, we'll do some executive action, but we'll take a recess till 11:15. 11:15. We'll be in recess till then.
just connecting with Caleb Bragg and emails back and forth.
Okay. All right. Getting close, though?
Should be.
Okay. Committee, let's be in order. We'll do some executive action. Starting with House Bill 79, I was told amendments are still being worked on, so put 79 back. Next, let's look at Senate Bill 204. This was by Senator Treibas, and it was revising driving under the influence laws. Mr. Vice Chair.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 204 do pass.
Ms. Krasowski, are there any amendments to Senate Bill 204?
There are no amendments prepared. I know the sponsor was thinking about an amendment, but he does not have the language to me.
Okay, thank you. Questions, comments, Senate Bill 204. Senator Friedel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to go on record to the fact, I think that the sponsor has the right idea to kind of think outside the box of trying to find a way that we could, I hate saying reward, but at least encourage good behavior after bad. However, I don't see, as the bill is written, where that does it. In fact, I believe it kind of gives us a liability as a state and law officers that it could cost us some dearly on this. So, unfortunately, without an amendment, I have to be a no on this. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Anyone else? Senator Kelker.
I'll just say me too. I don't think it's ready for prime time.
Senator Usher.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, there actually was a lawsuit in Yellowstone County that this bill would make it worse, so I definitely am opposed to it.
Senator Brown.
I would move to table Senate Bill 204.
Okay, that's non-debatable. We'll do a voice vote on tabling Senate Bill 204. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. One nay.
Senator Olson votes aye by proxy.
Okay. Two. Okay. We've got, that would be 9-2.
No.
Senate Bill 204 has been tabled. Ms. Gibney, do you get all of that? Okay. Next bill, Senate Bill 224, was by Senator Hertz, established a reporting requirement for court administrator dealing with judge cases. And Ms. Krasowski, there were some amendments, I think. Are they both ready?
There are four amendments to the bill, and they are all ready.
Four amendments, and they're all ready. That's where her time has been. Okay. Mr. Vice Chair.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 224 do pass.
Okay, and you should be getting four amendments. committee, you should have got amendments 1, 2, 3, and 4. Anyone not receive all four? Okay. Did you? Which ones did you get?
I got 1 and 4.
Senator Kelker, you have all four now?
I do, thank you.
Okay. We will start with the First Amendment. Mr. Vice Chair?
Mr. Chair, I move Amendment SB 0224.001.001.
Ms. Krasowski, can you fill us in? This is from the bill sponsor.
Yes, the First Amendment is from Senator Hertz. It adds in subsection 2 that the report must identify for the previous calendar year the following information, and then under subsection 2A adds the number and type of case assigned to each district court judge.
Okay. Questions or comments on Amendment 1 to Senate Bill 224?
Question.
Question's been called. Let's try a voice vote on Amendment 001 to Senate Bill 224. All in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay.
Senator Olson votes aye by proxy.
Okay. Amendment 1 has passed unanimously.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 224 as amended.
Okay. And Senator Manzella, you have an amendment. Do you want to move that amendment?
Yes, sir. Yes, Mr. Chair. I would like to move SB 0224.001.002 do pass.
Okay. And would you fill us in on what you're doing here?
Yes, Mr. Chair and members. It's very important that we understand that we have a law on our books that is actually part of a federal law that if a child is in foster care for 15 of 22 months, it's an automatic reason to terminate parental rights, which is very egregious, particularly in times of crisis like COVID presented, where, you know, continuances were happening all the time. So this amendment is specific to track the number of continuances granted by each judge in family law cases and child abuse cases and in neglect cases as it relates to Title 41, Chapter 3, and whether those continuances were upon the motion of the party to the case or the court's own motion. And that's it, Mr. Chair.
Okay. So basically, who created the continuance, the party or the judge, right?
Right.
Senator Friedel?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a kind of a quick question. I know that I've looked at all the amendments. Are there going to be any issues with, say, the fourth one and the next two?
We'll get to that.
Okay, I was just curious. Yeah. Sorry.
Right now we're on Amendment 2. Any questions, comments on it? Senator Emmerich.
Question on this amendment. How will this be affected in relation to the bill that already passed this committee in regards to prohibition of a large majority of continuances in family law cases?
Which bill was that? If you're addressing that question to me, which...
I don't remember the actual number off the top of my head, but it did pass through here, and it was to limit the continuances on
Senator,
these cases.
Senator Gross, you have some insight?
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Senator Emmerich, I think this would just be some accountability on that end. This is just a report to the interim committee, so I think that would add accountability on that bill that we did pass out of this committee.
Thank you.
Anyone else?
Question.
Okay, question's been called for. We're on amendment
002 to Senate Bill 224. Let's try a voice vote. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay.
Senator Olson votes aye by proxy.
Amendment 002 has passed unanimously. Mr. Vice Chair.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 224 as amended twice to pass.
Okay. Amended twice. Okay. Let's go to Amendment 003. Mr. Vice Chair, you want to move that, please?
Yes, sir, Mr. Chair. I move Amendment SB 0224.001.003.
And committee, the bill in its original form talked about cases assigned to each judge, the number of times each judge is substituted, and talking about that substitution. And in talking with some other legislators, the reason for these substitutions can be any lawyer can ask for a substitution in a case. They're allowed one on that. And maybe they don't like a particular judge. So therefore, my amendment is on page 2. It would also gather information, the name of each attorney and the name of the attorney's law firm or employer who requests a substitution of a judge and the number of substitution requests the attorney makes for each judge. I think that can be very valuable information about the lawyers then, too. Senator Gross?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just kind of wondering what the interim committee might do with this information. Like, why would we need the names of those attorneys? Or I haven't heard that there is necessarily an issue with certain just what do you picture us doing with this information?
Senator, if a lawyer is continually asking for a substitute on a particular judge, I think that's valuable information and maybe finding out why are they doing that.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I'm going to speak generally. I think I will support your amendment, but and I'm going to support all of the amendments, but oppose the bill overall, Mr. Chair.
Well, Senator, you know, when I first read the bill, to me it was all about judges and how many times they're being substituted, whatever, but there's another reason why they are substituted. It's not just necessarily the judge. It could be the lawyer. So I think this is valuable information.
All right. Mr. Okay. Chair, that does make sense. And, yeah, I will support the amendment. And I'll wait on my other comment. Thank you.
Senator Brown, on the amendment?
Mr. Chair, I think the Vice Chair kind of made her own point. We haven't heard. This is going to be a way for us, too, here.
Okay. Amendment 003, can we try a voice vote?
Question.
All in favor of Amendment 003 on Senate Bill 224, say aye.
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 Opposed, nay.
Senator Olson votes nay by proxy.
Okay. 003 passed 10 to 1. 10 to 1. Okay. Mr. Vice Chair.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 224 as amended 3 times to pass.
Okay. And committee, we have a fourth amendment. Mr. Vice Chair.
Mr. Chair, I move Amendment SB 224.001.004 to pass.
Ms. Krasowski, can you fill us in there?
This amendment was also requested by Senator Hertz, and to subsection 2C, it adds, and the reason for the substitution to the end of that subsection.
And Senator Friedel, what you were asking before coordination here, this amendment 004 asked for the reason. The previous amendment never asked for a reason. It just asked who's doing it.
Yes, Mr. Chair. I just want to make sure there's no confliction in the amendments, because I believe this is a good bill, and I would like to have some open and transparent accountability of our judiciary as long as our justice in general.
Okay. Any other discussion on Amendment 004? Senator Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to support the amendment, but the one question I guess that just pops into my mind is reason. We may not be able to really share what that reason might be. There might be reasons that we can't make public, and so I don't know if that would interfere with that.
Like confidentiality issues.
Sure. Yeah, correct.
Ms. Krasowski, any insight on that?
I guess I don't understand the question.
If it's a confidentiality issue that they can't give the reason, then a reason won't be given? Think about it,
Mr. Chair.
Senator Gross.
Mr. Chair, I think that Senator Brown raised some really important issues there, and I think that I will not support the amendment because sometimes, especially in cases involving juveniles, there is confidential criminal justice information, and that may be part of the reason for a substitution request for a juvenile. And so I think we could run into some trouble there. Maybe it could be redacted, but I'm going to say no on this amendment to recognize the fact there is confidential criminal justice information out there.
Go ahead.
When substitution, so in every case, each party can request a substitution one time. And they do not have to give a reason for why the substitution, they're asking for a substitution. They can just request a substitution.
Okay. Senator Heimbaugh?
One more question. Well, I agree with that. Mr. Chair, I think they could just say just that. It's confidential. They can't have a reason. So.
Senator Gross.
One more question then. So they're allowed. Attorneys are allowed to request one substitution without giving a reason. Are they allowed to request a second substitution if they give a reason?
Ms. Krasowski.
After the first substitution, you could move to substitute a judge if you were able to show bias or some other reason that would require recusal, and so those they would have to provide that information for those.
Okay. Any other questions, comments on Amendment 4? We'll do a roll call vote on Amendment 004 to Senate Bill 224.
Senator Usher?
Yes.
Senator Gross?
No.
Senator Heinbaugh?
Yes.
Senator Emmerich?
Yes.
Senator Weber?
No.
Senator Manzella?
Yes.
Senator Olson?
Senator Olson votes no by proxy.
Senator Brown?
Yes.
Senator Friedel?
Yes.
Senator Kelker?
No.
Senator Regeer?
Yes.
7 vote yes, 4 vote no.
Okay. So Amendment 004 has passed. Mr. Vice Chair.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 224 as amended 4 times do pass.
4 times. Questions, comments on Senate Bill 224 amended 4 times? Senator Kelker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will be voting no on this bill because I think this information is available already, and if the committee wants it, they can ask for it. I think it's just code clutter. Each of the district courts has its own differences, And I'm used to our district court giving us tons of information, and I just think this is unnecessary.
Anyone else? Comments? Senator Manzella.
Mr. Chair, as I indicated previously concerning the amendment concerning child neglect and abuse and family law cases, it's really hard to gather that data together. And again, we are talking about automatic termination of parental rights just because you've hit a 15-month threshold. That's the trigger for elimination of parental rights. So we desperately need some way of gathering this that information, and I really appreciate that the bill as amended will do that. So I'm a strong supporter.
Senator Heimbach.
Question.
Question's been called for. We'll do a roll call vote on Senate Bill 224, amended four times.
Senator Usher?
Yes.
Senator Gross?
No.
Senator Heinbaugh?
Yes.
Senator Emmerich?
Yes.
Senator Weber?
No.
Senator Manzella?
Yes.
Senator Olson?
Senator Olson votes no by proxy.
Senator Brown?
Yes.
Senator Friedel?
Yes.
Senator Kelker?
No.
Senator Regeer?
Yes.
7 vote yes, 4 vote no.
Senate Bill 224, amended four times, has passed committee. Next, Senate Bill 229 was by Senator Usher. And I don't think we were waiting on an amendment there. Senator Usher working on, fiscal note. We got the fiscal note. You're not working on any amendments, correct?
There was an amendment.
It was passed out yesterday.
Okay. Go ahead and move your bill.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 229 do pass.
And Ms. Krasowski, one amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay, should be getting one amendment to Senate Bill 229.
Chair.
Go ahead.
I'd like to move Amendment SB 0229.001.001.
Okay. Fill us in on what it does.
Mr. Chair, members, this actually was at the request of the authors, and it basically gives the Attorney General rulemaking authority.
Okay. Senator Gross.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I like this amendment. I did want to see some ability to prioritize where this would be paid. I'm going to support the amendment, but the one thing I was hoping the amendment would do, and I'm sorry I didn't have a chance to discuss this with the sponsor, but I would want to ensure that the Office of Public Defender was, there was some fairness or that they were receiving kind of an equal amount of money for expert witnesses. And without that information, you know, I'll just say it now. I'm supporting the amendment, but without that information for OPD, I'm not going to support the bill, unfortunately.
Senator Emmerich.
I think in regards to OPD, they are already funded, and in testimony they said that they actually end up paying a large majority of these costs for these counties, so I don't think that this in any way negatively impacts OPD.
Anyone else? Senator Usher.
I would just, Mr. Chair, weigh in on that. We discussed almost like an open checkbook for OPD, and it was actually financially before this really was to the advantage of the OPD in a case, and that's one of the reasons why they needed this funding for the prosecution side.
Anyone else on Amendment 001? Okay, let's try a voice vote. All in favor of Amendment 001 to Senate Bill 229, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay. It passed.
Olson votes aye by proxy.
Amendment 001 passed unanimously. Mr. Vice Chair?
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 229 as amended once to pass.
Questions, comments on the amended bill? Senator Gross.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Vice Chair. Thank you for working on this and making sure that on both sides of this issue that there is money for expert witnesses. I guess my concern is just that I would want to see equal amounts going to both sides. And I like that we're trying to balance between the needs of rural and urban counties. I was hoping that there would be some language that would ensure there was kind of a balance based on the needs of what OPD was receiving for expert witnesses and the county attorneys. Mr. Chair.
Anyone else? Okay, let's do a roll call vote on Senate Bill 229 amended once.
Senator Usher?
Yes.
Senator Gross?
Yes.
Senator Heinbach?
Yes.
Senator Emmerich?
Yes.
Senator Weber?
Yes.
Senator Manzella? Senator Olson?
Senator Olson votes yes by proxy.
Senator Brown?
Yeah.
Senator Friedel?
Yeah.
Senator Kelker?
Yes.
Senator Regeer?
Yes.
11 vote yes.
Senate Bill 229 is passed out of committee. Next, we'll look at Senate Bill 231. This was by Senator Lenz. Task Force to study dependency and neglect in the court system. Anybody working on amendments?
There are amendments.
There are amendments, okay. Okay, Mr. Vice Chair.
Is this the one they said we were going to go to table?
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 231 to the table.
Senate Bill 231 has been moved to table. It's non-debatable. We'll do a roll call vote.
I have no problem.
Senator Usher?
Yes.
Senator Gross?
No.
Senator Heinbach?
Yes.
Senator Emmerich?
Yes.
Senator Weber?
No.
Senator Manzella?
Yes.
Senator Olson?
Senator Olson votes no by proxy.
Senator Brown?
Yes.
Senator Friedel?
Yes.
Senator Kelker?
No.
Senator Regeer?
Yes.
7 vote yes, 4 vote no.
7-4 vote. Senate Bill 231 has been tabled. Committee, one more that we'll look at is Senate Bill 265. This was by Senator Nolan, and basically what it does is raise the fine for trafficking. And there's amendments on it. Okay. Mr. Vice Chair.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 265 do pass.
Okay. Ms. Krasowski, amendments?
Mr. Chair, there is one amendment.
One amendment. Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Vice Chair, would you move the amendment, please?
Mr. Chair, I move amendment SB0265.001.001. Do pass.
Ms. Krasowski, can you fill us in what it does?
Yes, this amendment is from Senator Noland. It removes Section 5. Section 4 and Section 5 were the same amendments, so this removes the extra section.
Are we saying this was a drafting error?
Question. Yes, we
are. Okay, amendment 001. Question's been called for. All in favor of amendment 001 to Senate Bill 265, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay.
Senator Olson votes aye by proxy.
Okay, amendment 001 is passed. Mr. Vice Chair.
I'm sorry.
You want to move the bill as amended once?
Yes. Mr. Chair, I move SB 265 as amended. Do pass.
Questions, comments on the amended bill? Senator Gross.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In concert with the bill we heard this morning, I think this bill sends a strong message to people about trafficking in Montana, that we take the crime very seriously, and I'm always very cautious about enhancing penalties, but this crime is so heinous, as we heard this morning. I'm very supportive of the bill. Thank you.
Anybody else? Okay. Let's try a voice vote on Senate Bill 265, amended once. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay.
Senator Olson votes aye by proxy.
Senate Bill 265, amended once, has passed unanimously. Committee, I think tomorrow is had two bills, but no, three bills, but one got moved on the floor yesterday. Is that right, Senator Heimbaugh?
Mr. Chairman, it isn't right, but it's true.
Okay, correct statement. Okay, so we have, I think, two bills tomorrow. Let me check here. Two bills tomorrow, and we do have some executive action to be working on. So if you're working on amendments, talk to Ms. Krasowski about that. Senator Kelker.
Mr. Chair, the bill that we had today on trafficking, it's ready to vote on, is it not?
Mr. Chair. Was somebody going to work on an immediate effective date on that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, we need that. There's no need of waiting a few months till October, whatever. No. So, no. Yeah.
But that's in the works, right?
And you'd like to see it ASAP, right? Okay. So, think you could have that tomorrow?
There's some bills that need to be potentially coordinated with.
Okay.
So I need to talk to some bill sponsors.
Okay. All right. Anyone else? Good. We'll see you on the floor at 1:00. We are adjourned.